I was 15 when I first spoke my truth. When you grow up and you're not taught what love is from a really young age, and you're taught that your body is like objectified as like a sex, you know, instrument, how are you supposed to even understand what love even feels like or what that even means? I remember after my grandfather died, seeing pictures of her and feeling really angry with her, feeling like, why didn't you fight back? Why didn't you save us? Why am I in this place? And I was putting so much blame on her. In reality, she had survived the worst, and she was the reason why, and is the reason why I'm sitting here right now. I have healed more in the last 6 months than I have in the last 47 years of my life. Mm-hmm. And it was because my inner child didn't feel safe around any of these people. And why would she? It's people that didn't believe her. It's people that betrayed her. It's people that abused her. It's people that ignored her. It's people that called her a drama queen when she was calling out for help. So why would she feel safe? Mm-hmm. And so until we can let our inner child feel safe, they're never going to trust us to heal.
Warning, the following episode contains content that may be triggering and or disturbing for some viewers. Viewer discretion is advised. Please see the description below for help and support resources.
This is Rooted Recovery Stories, and I'm Patrick Custer, your host. So very excited to be here in Los Angeles with my new friend, Kimberly Murphy, stunt woman, author, SAG Award winner, and so many more things. The list goes on and on when I read your accolades of all the amazing things to describe what you've done and what you're doing and what you're going to do. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We've got your lovely book here, and we're going to talk about so much of it. I think that the theme of the healing that, the struggle and the healing that's taken place, there's such a great, I don't know if metaphor, allegory, so many words to describe the fact that, you know, the profession that you fell into or fell into is a stunt woman, but, you know, of healing from trauma, like the childhood trauma, you know, you regularly are on movie sets, these huge movie sets, getting in harm's way, surviving obstacles and, you know, hardship, like things that where in, if this was real life, like people would probably be dying, right? Like, and you're learning how to like make it through hopefully unscathed. You did this in real life, except it was real life and not a movie.
Correct. And worse, I would say. I wouldn't say was worse. Yes.
Dramatic pause for a dramatic entrance. It's a really hard way to ask where on earth do we begin with where it began?
Well, I grew up in Long Island, New York, and my maternal grandfather and my mother's father has been diagnosed from many doctors, many huge trauma doctors, as a sociopath. He sort of went through life abusing everyone in his way, including me, and was not stopped by any adult, including my parents or my grandmother or anybody else who was in our life. And I was one of his many victims, and he died when I was 11, which is sort of when I like to say my life started to begin, I would say, but it began in a way of already receiving all of this trauma and pain. So I never really knew who I was or what I was meant to do on this earth. I was just trying to breathe. And that's pretty much how my teenage years went.
You're surviving.
Yes, 100%.
So respectfully and reverently and from a safety perspective, I want to ask if we could go back to and talk a little bit about what, so first of all, sociopathy, how did that play out as far as his characteristics in a grand scheme of things? And then with you, as far as you're willing to share, and from what you remember during those formative years.
I've done a lot of work on myself. I've done a lot of therapy. I've done a lot of EMDR. I've had a lot of amazing doctors by my side through my process. And through the process of writing was also another huge healing thing for me. And through my book, I got connected with incredible doctors who all endorsed my book. And Dr. Gabor Mate, who is one of the leading trauma doctors in the world, Dr. Richard Schwartz, who started Internal Family Systems.
Oh, wow.
He also became my therapist for a while, and I got to do a lot of parts work with him, which was extremely helpful in finding my inner child and connecting with her, because I was so disconnected from her. I felt like we were two separate people. I remember after my grandfather died and seeing pictures of her and feeling really angry with her, feeling like, why didn't you fight back? Why didn't you save us? Why am I in this place? And I was putting so much blame on her. And in reality, she had survived the worst, and she was the reason why, and is the reason why I'm sitting here right now. And she got me here. I didn't get us here. She did that. So doing that work with him and doing work with Gabor and doctors that he sort of put me in touch with. There's also an amazing doctor, Dr. Bruce Perry, who's written a bunch of books. One he wrote with Oprah called What Happened to You?
Yes.
He endorsed my book as well. And I had the amazingly got to get on many Zooms with him and have conversations with him about me writing this book, and this was all before I wrote it. And so I've had a lot of support around me, which I really needed at that time. Getting validation from trauma doctors, I needed so much while I was writing this, because I never got validation from my family. So getting validation from these doctors was everything for me. And I think it's what really pushed me through to continue writing. And knowing how important it was to put my story into the world. There are so many people that have suffered from incest and interfamilial abuse, and my abuse goes from generation to generation, that never speak about it. And now I know the reason why. Not that I didn't before, but it's so layered. And there's so much fear behind it, because there's so many aunts and uncles and grandma, you know, there's so many people that it's going to affect if you speak your truth. And so many people put themselves last instead of putting themselves first, instead of saying, speaking my truth. That's the first way we heal, is by speaking our truth, no matter how we speak it, whether it's we write it down, we say it out loud in a room full of nobody, we scream it, we write it, whatever that means for us, and it's different for everybody. Speaking our truth is our first step to healing. If you don't and can't speak your truth, you will forever be a prisoner of what happened to you.
What made it possible for you to first speak your truth? And when was that?
I was 15 when I first spoke my truth. But I was born this way, and through the work that I've done, and I've been, by the way, doing the work for those who are listening that feel helpless, I've been doing the work since I was 15 and I'm 47. So it's not, you know, an overnight thing, and it's not something that happens in a year that you heal from. It was a huge process for me. I've stepped away from my entire family now.
Wow.
What I realized through my healing was that nobody was moving except for me. Everybody was, you know, and I hate to say very happy, but content with staying where they were, because I think the fear of the unknown or the fear of what healing might look like for them was too frightening. So it was easier for them to just stay where they were. And that was never who I was. I was always born with a big voice. Mm-hmm. I was born knowing what was right and wrong and what was okay and not okay. And I didn't have parents telling me what was okay and what wasn't okay. Mm-hmm. So it was just something that was in me. And through the work that I did and through just part of who I always was, I knew that that was not what I was going to be.
Mm. What happened when you started to speak your truth at 15?
I told my mom that I was having flashbacks, and she just ran out of the room, which was very, obviously jarring for me. Because I was
like, you told her and she just turned around and ran out of the room.
Yes. I said, I'm having these flashes, like something really bad happened to me. And she just ran out of the room. And then about a few minutes later, she came back in the room and she said, you're not going to go to school tomorrow. We're going to go to my therapist. Go to bed. And I was like, you have a therapist? I had no idea my mom was even in therapy. Wow. My mom was 40 at the time. She was dealing with her own flashbacks and memories from her father that I did not know of and was not aware of. I didn't know at the time who it was. I saw figures and things happening, but I didn't know. I couldn't put a face to it. That often happens, especially when it's a family member, because it's somebody that we're supposed to love. I never loved my grandfather, but it's somebody we're supposed to love and is supposed to take care of us. So the next day I was in her therapist's office, and it was extremely traumatizing for me because I was sitting with my mom and the therapist was like, tell me every, you know, it was very aggressive and not healthy and extremely toxic. And I was like in a whirlwind of just trying to make sense of my life. Sometimes I'm still in that whirlwind.
Right.
And we did that for a little while, and then she got me my own therapist, and I went through a phase where I was just super angry at everything, and the therapist she got me, I just refused to speak. So I went to her, I think probably 6 months, and I just didn't speak because I was like, I don't like what's happening and I'm just not going to talk. And so I didn't.
Wow. So did you... you shut down at that point. Did you feel like you weren't being heard? What about that process made you go inward?
Well, it's interesting because I don't think at that time I really knew what was happening or why I was going inward. Mm-hmm. Now I do. My father did not believe me when I said that I was abused. My father was a Vietnam vet. He was in the Marines. He enlisted at 18, went to Nam, obviously had his own trauma. Mm-hmm. And his whole thing was, this didn't happen under my watch kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he just sort of didn't accept that that was my truth. Mm-hmm. And so I had that. And then I had my mom just kind of shoving therapists down my throat, and she wasn't really seeing me because she couldn't see me because she was trying to figure out what the heck was going on with her. And this was her father and this is who she grew up with. And so I definitely was not being seen and not being heard. And as I've gotten older and as my memories have progressed in my healing, and now that I can see the full picture of how bad it really was, I know exactly what was happening, is that they couldn't and still can't see what the truth of my family actually is.
Mm. I get chills down my back thinking about the level of not being, I have my own experience of not being believed about different things, medical issues. But something so violating, I cannot imagine what that's got to feel like, coming from a family system, a whole family system, just being in denial. They'd rather live in the sick and let you, the victim, be the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Not to demonize your family, because this is something that you're telling the story of so many people right now. I would venture to guess that that's probably more of the norm,
mm-hmm.
that takes place.
Yeah.
Which is why, oh my gosh, is so your book Glimmer is, and you coming on platforms like this, telling your story is so freaking important, for more and more people to hear, just the way out, the hope. I'm interested to hear how did the abuse continue to, did it manifest in your life from this point forward, in other ways, until you really found a way to harness healing in a better, because at this point we're talking about, you said you stopped talking, you know, to that specific mm-hmm. therapist. How was it playing out and stealing life from you?
I think it's interesting, because when you come from a toxic family, it manifests itself in all the ways, right? So through my 20s, every boyfriend I had was, you know, I considered it lucky to just have attention from a guy. So it didn't need to be anything actually meaningful or love or anything. It was just attention, whether that was negative attention, which usually that's what it was. You know, I did have definitely drugs happening through my 20s. And, you know, I think that when you grow up and you don't see, or you're not taught what love is from a really young age, and you're taught that your body is like objectified as like a sex, you know, instrument, how are you supposed to even understand what love even feels like, or what that even means? So I literally felt like I was surviving my whole life. I never saw myself living past 30. I never saw myself having a happy life. I never saw myself deserving to have any of it. It's just, I literally just felt like I was surviving every day. And in my early 20s, I was a dancer, and I had gotten into Alvin Ailey professional program at 23, which was kind of a big deal. And it was like everything good that happened to me, either I self-sabotaged or something happened in my life. I got in a really bad car accident while I was in the professional program at Ailey, and the doctors told me I would never dance again, which obviously was not true. But everything that happened, it felt like, yeah, well, of course, like this is what I deserve. This is what's supposed to happen. Like, I'm not, you know, something good happens and then I'm just going to wait for something really bad to happen on top of it, because mm-hmm. why would anything good ever happen to me?
Right.
And that's how I went through most of my life.
My gosh. So what changed?
I was always different from my family. I was that kid that was, you know, my dad was a drinker, and I was the daughter that was like, you're drunk, and I, you know, and so because of that, he was very physical with me, which I don't write about in the book. I was always the one to speak out. It was just, like I said, it was kind of partly how I was born. And partly why it's interesting, because I named the book Glimmer, because I always felt like I had that like glimmer inside me that like mm-hmm. never went out.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I named it shortly after, I found out that it's glimmer is the opposite of trigger, which I actually did not know when I wanted to call the book Glimmer. Mm-hmm. But it's opposite of trigger. And it was just part of who I was. But then as I grew, there was just something in me that knew that I was meant for more, and knew that I think there are certain people that are put on this earth to either, like, we all walk around and either you're watching people repeat cycles or you're watching people break cycles.
Yeah.
And it's one or the other, literally.
That's so true. There's not an in between.
No. It's interesting because I've always been alone, right? Literally. So my parents, I was born and my parents are my parents, but I don't believe that they're my parents. And that's a whole other spiritual thing that if I talk about, people will think I'm nuts, but that's fine. but I believe that I was put here to do this thing, mm-hmm. and that I needed to come through my parents to do this thing. And obviously I was born into a family that I was born into and abused. And when I was 15, I didn't understand. I knew I was sexually abused, but I had flashes of things, right? I didn't really understand like the level of abuse. And so through therapy and through doing IFS, which is a huge, huge help for me, and doing EMDR and all those things, for a long time, I went with the narrative in my head of, okay, yeah, your grandfather like touched you, or like, you know, things happened, and, you know, I knew I was raped. I knew that that had happened. But even that, I always minimized. I always sort of did that. I think I needed to do that for myself to survive, because if I really looked at what that meant, mm-hmm. it was way too big for me to handle.
Yeah.
My grandmother was a huge component of isolating me, because she was completely aware of what was happening to me and did absolutely nothing about it. There was many times that she walked in situations and did nothing. There was many times my mother walked in situations and did absolutely nothing. Just recently, in one of my sessions, I remembered that my grandfather always carried a knife with him, like everywhere. And I have these two scars in my mouth from here to here on the inside of my mouth. I've had them my whole life. Never like questioned them or like knew where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of my sessions, remembered that he had taken a knife and cut both of the insides of my mouth. I was 7.
Mm.
I think he knew how strong my voice was. I think my voice scared him. I think everybody who came before me that he abused, he was not scared of, and I think he was scared of me. I have multiple stab wounds on my body from him. And that's what he did to silence me. And there is nothing more isolating than that.
My gosh. I feel like I just held my breath the whole way through that. And as I reflect on what I was feeling as you said that and holding my breath, I can't help but think that, like, how many times you probably held your breath or disassociated just to escape what was going on. But it didn't silence you.
Yeah.
I have to ask, because I feel like so many abuse survivors that I talk to, that have been speakers of truth refusing to stay quiet, there's a common theme of, because in the family system, that's what they do. The rest of the family is, they would rather stay comfortable and ignore what's going on. There's a finger pointed that you're the dramatic one that overreacts to everything. Therefore you get looked at as the problem in a manner of ways. Mm-hmm. Was that something that would you say that that narrative happened for you because of how outspoken you were in your family?
Well, that's a typical family scapegoat, right? So if you're familiar with Dr. Romney's work, who does a lot of work around narcissism, and many families who come from abusive families have a lot of narcissistic people in the family. Mm-hmm. So my grandparents were completely narcissistic, my parents also. And in one of my interviews with Dr. Romney, actually, we talk about that, and my dad would always say, he would say something super cruel, and he would say, I'm just joking, which is basically like, he says something cruel, I register that it's cruel, I'm hurt because it's cruel, and then it's back to Kimberly's dramatic. Don't be so dramatic. Don't be so dramatic. I was labeled the drama queen my entire life, and that's what everybody always called me. So whenever I acted out or tried to ask for help in ways that a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old asks for help, which is in not, I need help because you're 15 and you don't know how to ask for help and you've been traumatized your whole life. So you're asking for help in the only ways you know how, which for me, and I talk about this in the book, there was a moment where my parents had went out and I had taken a bunch of like NyQuil and I just like wanted to go to sleep. Like I was just in so much pain. I was like, I just want to go to sleep. Like I just need this to be over. Like I cannot, like I can't handle this and nobody's like getting it and no one's getting like the severity of it. And I sort of like put myself on the bottom of the stairs and I'd like put ketchup all over my face, you know, like I was hurt, which I mean, I wasn't, but I was, but that was my way of trying to say, help me. And my parents came home and my dad stepped over me and he said, Kim, get up. You're stop being so dramatic. And that was my childhood, literally.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
I have a 9-year-old child, and if she was laying at the bottom of the stairs with ketchup all over her face, my answer would not be get up.
Right.
It would be, where are we what's going on and what is happening with you? And everything would be all about her 24/7 until we figured it out.
Yeah.
And I think becoming a mom for me, that is really when I really split from my parents, because when you become a parent, everything shifts because you see the things that you would do for your child and cannot understand how your parents couldn't do that for you.
Did you believe them at that point? Did you think you were dramatic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I always thought I was making a big deal out of nothing. And what's so interesting about this new thing that I was speaking about my scar, like my literal scars on my body, is that I can't tell you how many times I've looked at them in the mirror and just to myself been like, you didn't make it up, Kim.
God.
Which is like a very freeing space to be.
Yeah.
Painful, but freeing.
Right.
What emotion do you have right now?
Yeah.
Oh God, I'm so fucking mad at them. I like Gabor and I, he hates when I do that. It's like, don't laugh. It's not funny. And that's like my nervous anxiety laugh because it isn't funny. But, you know, we have a lot of, if you follow the teachings of Gabor, he speaks about your emotional being, your body and your emotional being and how connected they are and how illness manifests itself in our body through trauma. If we don't heal our trauma, it will manifest in illness. And that's what he believes. And it's interesting because I had my gallbladder out years ago, and my mom doesn't have a gallbladder, and neither does my grandmother. And it's your gallbladder is where you hold your aggression and your anger.
Wow.
So, and I'm obviously like a very healthy, like worked where I, you know, I'm still like worked out my whole life. I've take care of my body. I, you know, so my gallbladder almost exploded and I had to have like emergency surgery to have it taken out. And it's interesting because I feel like it goes back to exactly what he's saying. I was never able to vocalize my pain and it manifested itself there.
Hmm. Fast forward to the point where, like, as you as you're moving into adulthood, what was, you know, we talked about how like you were self-medicating and doing different things that to either numb or whatever to cope. what really changed to, because there had to have been a transition. You're a very accomplished and successful woman in the profession that you're in right now. What transpired over that period of time from, you know, living actively and, you know, partying all the time to starting to really heal and become a more high functioning individual?
Well, I'm still healing. And I feel like that's something that's so important for when my book first came out and I first started doing interviews, I feel like that was something that was so spoken about, you know, how did you heal yourself and how did you heal yourself? And I'm not healed. Mm-hmm. I'm healing. And I think we're all healing forever, mm-hmm. no matter what we've been through, right? Because there's all stages of it. And we also go through stages of our life. Our life is continuously changing. Mm-hmm. And the people around us are continuously changing, hopefully getting better as we heal into a higher place and a better space. And so I was in a marriage that with another survivor. And we sort of connected on that, and it was a really unhealthy relationship. Although he was a great person, we just sort of connected in that space, and I was sort of doing the work and he wasn't. And so it became very difficult for us to be together. And I went away to do a film, and I met my husband on a movie, my husband now. and I want to say it was sort of the universe just saying, like, we're going to give this to you because, like, we're really sorry.
Yeah.
And because I definitely was not ready to accept him in my life. He came from really normal, like, you know, normal parents, normal life, like very lovely person and didn't have issues and you know, any of that. And so definitely did not feel deserving of him at all. And when I left for the film, my then husband and I were, once I got on this movie, I filed for divorce. And so I met my husband on the movie. And I think if he was here, he would say for the first year of our relationship, I cried every day. because he was just so kind to me, and I had never had anybody who was just kind to me because they thought I was worth being kind to. Mm. And we've been together now 15 years and have a child together and built a house together. And I don't really actually know how that happened.
It's beautiful. But what I hear, and then I think that is so beautiful, is that I believe that you believe you deserve that today.
Yeah.
I don't know that however long ago the Kimberly back then would have believed it.
I think the Kimberly back then knew it, and then she was tainted with a lot of bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. So we talked a little bit, I think, before we started rolling about our inner child.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the journey yours has taken.
So when I first started doing inner child work, my inner child was living not with me. We were very separate. And I would see pictures of her and be really angry with her and feel like she didn't fight for us and didn't protect us. And now with all of the memories that I have, I know that she was exactly the opposite of that. And through all of the work that I've done, I like to say she has a little bed inside my body here where she lives, and we're one person for probably the first time since birth, I want to say. And it's a really beautiful, peaceful feeling.
It's beautiful to hear that. I like the way you described it. I think when we talk about inner child work, everyone's description is so different about the resolution of where they are now. That's so beautiful. I'm really curious to hear what, and I'm sure you probably talk about a lot of this in your book, but what do you say to the person out there who is in the middle of a similar situation that's either using their voice or not using their voice, but it's not changing anything?
I think it doesn't change anything when you surround yourself with the people that made you sick.
Mm.
And that took me a really long time to get that. But it's 100% true. And it's really hard. It's like the attachment versus the authenticity. You know, we come into this world, we're attached to our parents, we're attached to our siblings. But if we can't show up in an authentic way to our parents and an authentic way to our siblings or our aunt, whoever it is that we're close with, then we're betraying ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then we can never heal. You cannot heal around the environment that made you sick, period. That's just it. And sometimes it takes people, it took me a really long time to come to terms with that and to walk away. And the book was the start of that. Mm-hmm. Because once I got my book deal, one of my sisters just totally ghosted me. The other one was very close behind. And then there were just things that were happening in my family system that were really toxic that I didn't want my daughter to be around and I didn't want to be around. And I realized that my mother was the last person I walked away from. And I realized that, and it's only been 6 months with my mom, that I have healed more in the last 6 months than I have in the last 47 years of my life. And it was because my inner child didn't feel safe around any of these people. And why would she? It's people that didn't believe her. It's people that betrayed her. It's people that abused her. It's people that ignored her. It's people that called her a drama queen when she was calling out for help. So why would she feel safe? Mm-hmm. And so until we can let our inner child feel safe, they're never going to trust us to heal. Mm-hmm. So you have to get to a space that you can be strong enough to walk away. And I think it's a lot easier than people think that it is. Once you do it, you realize how much space and how much peace you actually do have. And it doesn't mean that it needs to be forever.
Yeah.
And that's something that I you know, I don't know what the journey of my parents are going to be or my siblings are going to be. And I hope that their journey is a healing one. And if one day it is, and that brings us back together, then that's a great thing. But right now, that's not what it is. And so for me and my husband and my daughter, this is the journey that I need to walk for myself.
When there's something to be said about the power of prioritizing your own healing above others' needs and comfort.
Well, we're conditioned, especially when we're raised in an abusive household, that our feelings don't matter and that we're the last people that we think about and we're the last people that we take care of. So of course you take that into adulthood.
Yeah.
How could you not?
Yeah.
That's what you're, it's like looking at your child and telling them that they're ugly every day. When they get older, what are they gonna, they're gonna look in the mirror and say that they're ugly. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, they say it's so important when I, when my daughter's sitting with me and I'm looking in the mirror and I'm, you know, it's how I speak to myself. Mm-hmm. She hears that. That's a reflection of what she hears me speaking about myself is how she's going to feel about herself.
That's right.
So if I don't have respect for myself and I don't put safe people in her world, she's not going to be safe. And that's what was done to me. And I refuse to do that to her. So a lot of times the catalyst for people are their children. I'm not going to put my kid in that position. I'm not going to do that to my kid. Well, if you're not going to do that to your kid, then why would you do it to yourself? Mm. And there are so many people that have been abused and have gone through things that don't want to have kids. And I get that totally. And everyone has their own journey. And, you know, you don't have to have children to live a full life. And right. Everyone has their own path. But so many people, and I get this a lot with my book and with my messages, you know, I don't want to ever have children because I feel like I never want them to put them through what I went through. Mm-hmm. But if you can walk away from the environment that made you feel that you were this person that you never were, you can give yourself, and if you choose to have children, a life that is completely different than what you had.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
So my ex-husband and I were struggling a lot. And right before I went to go do this film that I met my husband on, which was super like fun trivia movie fact and cheesy as heck. But we did Night and Day, which was Cameron Diaz and Tom Cruise. So I double Cameron Diaz forever and he double Tom Cruise. And that's how we met. And it's a laughable situation. But anyway, right before I left, my ex-husband had said to me, when you come back from this movie, I want to start having kids. And it was like everything in me was like, absolutely, I can't have children with you. That was the first mm-hmm. thing that came to my mind. And there was always that voice, which I call my glimmer, always that voice deep down that always was guiding me in the right way, even when there was so much ugliness on top of it. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those moments for me where I was like, yeah, no, I can't have kids with you. And that's not what I'm, that's not what's going to happen.
Does it make sense to you now why you were mad at her?
Why I was mad at her?
Your inner child.
I was mad at her because I believed in my head that she never fought back. Because I thought that if she had fought back, that we wouldn't be in the position we were in. But in actuality, now that I have full memories, she fought like hell. Mm. And also, she was the one who I was the most connected with because everybody else was completely disconnected from me. So she was actually the only one that I had any kind of relationship with. Whether it was, I hate you, I love you, I'm mad at you, whatever it was more than anybody else was giving me.
Right.
So we had that, I feel like that connection.
It only helps to get mad at someone who, you know.
Cares.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A really good point.
She definitely cared.
So I want to ask, what made you decide to get public about your story and put it into a book? I mean, this is a huge step.
Yeah.
And what do you hope to accomplish?
Yeah. Writing a book is no joke. It's not, yeah, it's not easy to get a book deal either. It's really a whole different situation. But I always wanted to write it. And interestingly enough, about 20 years ago, me and my family were writing it together. I was writing it with all of my sisters, my mother, my aunt. My aunt Pat is a very big, prominent figure in the book. She was the first person to come forward about my grandfather when she was 9. She told my grandmother what he was doing. My grandmother confronted him. He denied it. And everything just went on as it was. My grandfather also left confession letters when he died, confessing everything that he did to all of us. But we were all writing for a really long time together. And it wasn't a book, really. It was sort of like an exorcism of just our memories and feelings and things. And I think for at that time in our life, it was important that we needed to like get it out, mm-hmm. but it wasn't a book. And once COVID happened and I wasn't working, and I don't do very well at sitting still. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna do this book. And I found a ghostwriter and I started doing a proposal. And it was something that I've always wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I want to make a film from it. That's something I've always wanted to do. That will also happen eventually. It was never an option for me not to tell my story. And the things that shifted with my sisters was that everybody had kids. And we all felt differently about how we wanted to handle the next generation, mm-hmm. which is really interesting, right? So they wanted to handle it where, okay, I get it. Like, this is what our family was, but let's like sweep it under the carpet and mm-hmm. we're just going to raise our kids. It doesn't work like that. Right. Your trauma just doesn't like magically disappear.
Yeah.
It would be super great if it did, but it doesn't work like that. And I was always going to tell my daughter when it was appropriate time what had happened to me, because I always felt that it would help her understand me better as a mother. I'm not a perfect mom. I have a lot of stuff that I have to work through on a daily basis. And sometimes it comes through my parenting, and that's very normal. And it just wasn't something that I was never going to not tell her. And we just disagreed on that. And thankfully so, in the sense of I needed to write this book on my own, like on my own terms, by myself, the way that I did it. And everything came together really beautifully. And, you know, we sold it to HarperCollins in like 6 days. Wow. And Cameron Diaz wrote the foreword for it. And I had like every major trauma doctor endorse it. And everything just, you know how they say when you're meant to do something, everything will just sort of mm-hmm. fall into place. Everything just fell into place. Mm.
So I get it. You were meant to do it. You were called to do it. And this may sound so cliche to ask you, and the answer is kind of obvious, but I just want to hear from your heart, like what do you hope this book goes and does for generations and for other people suffering and survivors out there?
You know, 90% of people that are abused by a family member or somebody the family knows, which is a massively high number. Mm-hmm. It's insane. Meaning that it's like an uncle or a neighbor mm-hmm. or somebody that we trust enough to say, here, can you watch my kid for 2 hours? And there's so much shame around it, which is why so many people don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And I just feel like if people can find some strength in me to speak about it, even if it's one person, and I know already that it's been more than that, that it's worth everything to me.
Absolutely.
And I wrote it for my little Kimberly. Yeah. She got to speak the truth in front of the whole world.
Those are some really, really great reasons. Gosh, I can't thank you enough for also opening up, getting vulnerable and sharing on, allowing us to share your story on our platform as well. You know, I mentioned at the very beginning, and I kind of want to talk about this. I'd be beside myself if I didn't, because I'm so interested, because there's like I said, a parallel here. Mm. You know, you're a survivor, you're a fighter, and you went into this career of being a stunt woman where you're like the person like surviving through all of these chaotic things regularly in all of these giant Hollywood movies. How did that start for you? And I don't know, I just, whatever you want to share about that, I'm just so interested about how that came to be.
Yeah. A lot of my friends were getting into stunt work. I was, after Ailey, I became a professional acrobat. So I was like traveling the world doing like Cirque du Soleil. It was the same type of company. And a lot of my friends were getting into it and they were like, you should send your stuff in. You know, that's when we like mailed things. And so a coordinator called me and I got my first job was my super ex-girlfriend doubling for Uma Thurman. It was all wire work and things that I was very used to doing. And so that was my first job, never stopped working since. The prologue actually speaks about this, about a film that I did called I Am Legend, where I get really injured at work. And, you know, there's definitely a correlation between people that have suffered severe trauma and high intensity sports, you know, athletics, like 100%. I feel like, you know, MMA fighters and stunt people and people that really push their bodies to the limit. There's definitely, I'm not saying with all people, but with some people, there's definitely, I think, trauma living in there somewhere. For me, there definitely was. For me, there was a sense of something felt very familiar to me of getting injured, felt comfortable. It felt safe in a really, you know, sounds bizarre, but for me, that was my whole life. So it was something that I really was attracted to in an unhealthy way. I was a cutter growing up as well. So it was something that just sort of made sense. Where I can now reflect on that, and I'm in a much different space than I was, but I definitely started my career and went through a lot of my career living in that space of getting injured, not caring, not going to the doctor, you know, just sort of being in that space. And I think that that's, you know, I always say no one like wakes up in the morning and is like, I'm going to go do a car hit and this is so exciting. And, you know, but that's what I did for a long time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're still working and still doing all of, you're still doing stunt work, no?
I'm coordinating now.
Oh, really?
So I'm like in charge of things.
Oh, nice. Okay, so you're out of harm's way.
I mean, I do stunts still, but not like I was.
Okay.
No, there are many things that I did in my career that I would never do now.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice to be in a place where you're still getting to do what you love, but from a place of a little bit more safety.
Yes, in. Yes. And yeah. Also taking care of the people that work for you in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, back then when I started, things were much different. And things are shifting now in that world too, which is nice as well.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. I am excited to go through the list because I saw it and I've seen so many of the movies that you, I mean, like, I challenge each y'all listening to go look at all the movies that Kimberly's been in because it's like endless. And but now I want to go look and see if I find all the action scenes that you were in because I think it's really cool. Really, really cool. So is your, just your, your heart, your presence, your energy is, I think goals when we talk about the evolution of healing, you're always either breaking, God, I love what you said. You are always either, breaking cycles or, continuing them,
repeating them.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And when you're a cycle breaker and you're in that process and you're on the trajectory of healing, It's so evident. It's contagious. And I feel that so much sitting across from you,
you.
And talking to you. So I just thank you for following your heart, listening to your inner child, taking care of her, and putting good back into the world.
Thank you.
It's wonderful. Thank you for being here today and sharing your voice.
Thank you.
It's been amazing.
Thank you.
Last question for that person or people who have resonated with your story. What last word of encouragement would you like to leave with them?
Don't be so hard on yourself. Because when you're hard on yourself, you're hard on your inner child. And I've never been that person, but I'm so that person now. And it's really, really important because they've been through enough.
That's true. You heard it here, folks. And with that, I will close out how I always do and remind each and every one of you that it is never too late to start loving yourself. And you're always ever one decision away from a completely different life.